I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the New Statesman's Hidden Histories podcast and our new series, The Great Forgetting, Women Writers Before Austen. Episode 2, Blue Stocking Culture. In 1783, Elizabeth Montagu wrote, "In a woman's education, little but outward accomplishments is regarded. Sure, the men are very imprudent to endeavour to make fools of those to whom they trust so much their honour and fortune, but it is in the nature of mankind to hazard their peace to secure power, and they know fools make the best slaves." Elizabeth Montagu was one of the leading lights of the Blue Stocking movement, where educated women gathered to discuss literature. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Sophie Colombo and Elizabeth Edwards to discuss the Blue Stockings. Who were they and why did they matter? Liz, I'm going to start with you first. Where did blue stocking culture come from?
Blue stocking culture is salon culture. It's a culture of exchange and conversation, discussion. It's originally, I guess, a continental model more than a British one. But it also reflects the way in which the 18th century, mid-18th century, is this kind of conversable world, this age of sociability, this world of conversation in real life and then also in print. And the boundaries between the two of those, as we might see, are really not as fixed as you might think.
So what were the kind of prerequisites to have a salon of your own? Well, a big room. Yeah. How achievable was this for somebody? How rich did you have to be?
You had to be pretty rich. You had to be pretty well off. And Elizabeth Montagu, who was kind of called the Queen of the Blues, was seriously wealthy, as was Hester Piozzi, not to the same extent, but she held a kind of rival salon elsewhere. But both of these women are really very privileged women in the period, with plenty of money to fund all kinds of schemes, to be patrons of other writers.
And presumably that one of the reasons that this was so attractive to women was it was in your own home, it was in your living room, essentially, because I presume that coffee shops of the time, that kind of, you know, public spaces, you couldn't really hang around in them certainly not if you're an aristocratic woman.
No, they're complete no-go spaces for women in this period. So what do? You set up your own space where you can have this kind of conversable world and this life of dialogue and discussion. And it's a private space. It's a space that's by invitation only.
How often would you have one every day, or is that just, that would be madness?
No, I think they're every couple of weeks, something like that. Yeah. Is that right?
And seasonal as well, because, you know, certain seasons, one's out of London.
So it's one decamps to Bath to take the waters, presumably. The blue stocking ones, what's the kind of gender balance of them? I mean, they did invite men, didn't they? They weren't purely women's societies.
Yeah, men are sometimes present, but I mean, most of the accounts that we kind of look at now, I think really just, they emphasise the female collective. There are men there occasionally, but I think they kind of stand out as being unusual because this is really a gathering of women.
And Sophie, tell me, who is your favourite blue stocking?
Ooh, who's my favourite blue stocking? I think it would probably be Hester Piozzi. Hester Thrale, as she is in the heyday of blue stocking. She's just absolutely fascinating. She's set up as a rival to Elizabeth Montagu. And she's very, very vivacious. She attracts the great and the good, Samuel Johnson, Edmund Burke, the Burney family, and many, many others to her home. And she privileges wit and learning, but she also privileges play, playfulness, in a way that Elizabeth Montagu doesn't. Because what you have to understand is every blue stocking hostess has her own particular style. So Elizabeth Montagu's is very based around learning, very sort of, they discuss the classics.
Worthy. Are you going to say it's very worthy?
A bit worthy.
Is that the one that you get invited to and you think, oh, it's doing me good, but I'm not going to enjoy it when
You've
I go?
You've got to go. You have to know Elizabeth Montagu. But it wouldn't be as fun as a Hester Thrill gathering. Then you've got Elizabeth Vesey, who's another one. And she's famous for putting her chairs in a very odd way so that you can't get a circle. You can't get anything that resembles formality. And you have to get up and change so that you're sitting with different people. So every blue stocking hostess has their own personal style.
And Liz, have you got a favourite? Are you going to say Hester
Thrale
again? I'm going
to be boring and say Hester Thrale also.
Okay, you two, when we were planning this podcast out, both of you were just like, oh, Hester Thrale. what is the Hester Thrale love about?
She's just brilliant. she...
Was she much of a writer? Because, I mean, she's a letter writer, right?
But in this period, no, she's not. I mean, she has these two lives. She has this life as Hester Thrale, which is this salon culture period of her life, and then she has a whole new life as Hester Piozzi. So after the death of her first husband, she marries really quite scandalously an Italian music master, but it's in that phase of her life that she becomes the published writer, not really a blue stocking in the same way, not if we're thinking about debate and conversation as the kind of hallmark of blue stocking life, but what she does is she goes off trailblazing all kinds of non-fictional prose forms. So she writes a biography of Samuel Johnson. She's the first person, not quite the first person to write a biography, but the first person to write about him. And it is seen as a real landmark in the history of biographical writing because she pioneers this kind of, this casual form.
But, you know, I mean, Hester Thrale Piozzi's kind of playfulness is what kind of makes her my favourite, and the fact that she hasn't really been recognised as a fantastic innovative writer. But I think we need to highlight that many, many blue stockings were incredibly innovative writers, and they all kind of pushed boundaries and broke taboos in certain ways. Elizabeth Montagu wrote this fantastically successful essay on the genius of Shakespeare. I mean, if you want to think about how Shakespeare's reputation got built up as, you know, to the point where it is today, this kind of national treasure, this, you know, sort of talent beyond question, Elizabeth Montagu has a massive role in that, because Voltaire, another continental writer, has criticised Shakespeare and say, well, compared to other playwrights, no, you know, he's not what it's about. And Montagu's piece really becomes the standard that you refer back to for a long time.
Is this the period in which people were bowdlerising Shakespeare, or does that come later? At this point, are they performing King Lear with a happy ending?
Yeah, I think that's earlier 18th century. Noam Tate? Is it? Yeah, earlier 18th century, that's happening.
So I guess his reputation went through being sort of slightly like, ooh, it's a bit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so she is then the one who kind of begins that march of him to being...
To a large extent, yes, and she binds Shakespeare up with a sense of national identity. She says he is our national poet. She puts forward that case that there is something... I think it's peculiarly English, she says, not British, about him. But, you know, that for as a stroke of literary criticism, that's really important. You've then got someone like Elizabeth Carter, who's a fantastic classical scholar. She translates Epictetus for the first time. And, you know, she's known for this incredible kind of classical genius, which really I don't think you can highlight enough how difficult that is to achieve for a woman.
Well, that's what I was thinking as you were saying that. You know, how did those women get to the stage of, were they just lucky to have enlightened fathers who pay, would they have been schooled at home, I presume, in this period?
Well, schooled at home in certain accomplishments. They certainly wouldn't have gone to any kind of formal school. But even the accomplishments that they were schooled in, yes, I think to an extent you have to have an indulgent parent, or at least a parent who isn't very aware of what you're doing and up to, in order to achieve learning. Elizabeth Montagu had a very indulgent father and I think uncle, or maybe just one of them. But anyway, somebody who brought her along to his intellectual Cambridge conversations when she was a child so that she could learn. Elizabeth Carter, I think, was a little bit more self-schooled. I was telling Liz I was absolutely desperate to get this fact in of how Elizabeth Carter used to make time for her learning. She used to stay up all night, and in order to make sure she didn't fall asleep and she was, you know, sort of doing her classical learning and all this sort of stuff, she used to apparently wrap cold, wet towels around her head and fanatically sniff snuff. And she ended up with this, chew green tea. And she ended up with this snuff addiction and with headaches that came back to plague her all her life. So she made these sacrifices for her late night
just
learning.
At the point that I was thinking, this sounds like a really brilliant deadline, deadline beating thing. This is a total different. What is snuff? Is it just tobacco?
Yeah, you sort of snort it. You're supposed to put it in that little crook between your thumb and your forefinger and sniff it.
But how much, because, you know, there's all this sort of paraphernalia now to a writing life about all kind of distractions and all, you know, and people get obsessed with, you know, people write standing up. How much of that stuff comes across in writing the 18th century? How much are people writing about writing?
That's a really good question, and a lot of books have been written about it. There's a lot of concern about professionalisation of the writer going on in this period. I think there's still a great anxiety about what you lose reputationally if you admit that you're writing for money. So absolutely nobody, if they can help it, if they have a certain genteel way of life to uphold, absolutely nobody wants to admit that, even though it's often the case. Wouldn't have been for Elizabeth Montagu, she's incredibly wealthy independently, but somebody like a Burney or even an Elizabeth Carter could really have done with the money, to be honest.
But by publishing anonymously, Burney didn't get paid then, or?
No, she was paid. She would get a down payment for a manuscript when she went to the bookseller. She got practically nothing for her first novel, but then because it sold so well, she got a bit more for a second one. I think it was £200 and a pair of kid gloves for a second one. And then the third one, she was able to rake in the big bucks, and she built a house from the proceeds. And the fourth one, she got a massive advance. So, you know,
that is the classic Shirley. Fourth one, massive advance, terrible sales. And fifth one, yeah.
Got pulp.
But what we should say about Elizabeth Montagu as well is the reason that she's staying up half the night drinking green tea and wetting her hair really cold to make her stay awake is that she's basically a full-time carer for her father. So she's spending her days looking after someone else, and so she has to carve out the time in order to be able to write and think and learn in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
And she also buys a house with the proceeds of her translation of Epictetus. Mm-hmm.
She has a domestic...
That's Elizabeth Carter.
Elizabeth Carter, yeah.
Yeah. She has a domestic duty here. I mean... Samuel Johnson famously says of Carter, and this has been oft repeated as, you know, as if it's a good thing, whereas it's actually quite a bad reflection on Johnson, is, well, the thing about my good friend Mrs. Carter is she can bake a pudding as well as she can translate Epictetus, and she can embroider a hanky as well as she can write a poem or something. So there's that impetus.
Thanks, Sammy J.
So there's that impetus to have to balance these different roles.
But I think you still see that now, don't you? About when you see profiles of... There was that famous case with an astrophysicist, I think, or a female scientist who died recently, and the New York Times obituary said, you know, she was just as happy baking a pie as she was solving equations. And you were like, that's great, but I can't imagine a male obituary ever said, like, he was just as brilliant at embroidering a smock as he was running the World Bank.
There are really instructive parallels, I think. You know, lots of things you could say about continuity and change between... the 18th century and the present, when we're talking about learned women, one only has to think about the absolute flack that Mary Beard got and gets for not looking, as some male columnists see it, a certain way when she presents her fantastic TV programmes. You know, to see that there are certain expectations that you'll maintain a dual role that, you know, male academics wouldn't necessarily come under.
But that's the kind of, yeah, doing it all, isn't it? Sort of having it all, is that you can do a bit of writing as long as you do all the feminine stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
What about Catherine Macaulay? She was a blue stocking as well, wasn't she?
Macaulay, yeah. I mean, just to go back to Snuff for a moment, there's an amazing...
Anytime, always.
There's an amazing anecdote about her. She is... I think she's the second woman ever to be admitted to the British Museum as a reader. And I think for a 10-year stretch, she's the only woman reader who goes there at all. So this is, again, it's not exclusively a male space, but by default it has become a male space because women just don't go there, they don't use it. And there's an anecdote about a fellow reader who rushes off to the corner of the room to relieve himself.
In the room?
In the corner of the room. He's called them back by his friend, who says, quick, come and look at this. So he races back, presumably unbuttoned, and exposes himself to Catherine Macaulay. When he realises what he's done, he can profusely apologise. I'm so sorry, madam, I'm sorry. And she says, do you know what? It's okay. There's no gender in here. And then takes some snuff from her hand.
Mic drop.
I've never heard that. That's brilliant.
I thought you were going to say, she said something like, don't worry, there really wasn't much to see anyway. But I guess the amount of sass that you could deliver in the 18th century was relatively limited.
But yeah, librarians out there, if you think people have bad library habits, I mean, snuff and exposing yourself.
I think this is something, but this is one of these perpetually fascinating things to me about, particularly about the 18th century, is that, you know, you have such high-flown poetry about it and, you know, these novels, and they seem very modern, but this was a time when it was people were pissing and spitting.
Oh, it's dirty, yeah.
All can we just talk a bit about, because I mean, blue stocking culture is firmly rooted in London. What was the London of the blue stockings like?
I think it was probably nicer than your average. You know, you get this exposure to very wonderful houses comparatively, polite spaces, grand parks, theatre, opera, whatever other sort of entertainments. But there would certainly be the dirty side of it. I mean, there's an anecdote about Piozzi that I don't know if I should let Liz tell about the...
I'll tell that one in a moment.
unfortunately, our listeners won't even be able to see the gesture that you just made. But I think that one is worth hanging on for. This is kind of to do with the rise of the Industrial Revolution and also the rise of mass production and mass consumption. Is this becomes a period, doesn't it, in which people actually begin to buy people have more than one set of clothes. I mean, mm-hmm. This is my theory. Ever before 1720 or something like that, everyone must have smelled pretty rancid. Mm-hmm. Because even if you were rich, you had, you know, underskirts that you changed and things like that. But you probably only had a couple of sets of clothes, didn't you?
When you look at somebody like Elizabeth Montagu and you look at all of these women, really, if you look at the portraits of them, I mean, they are the height of fashion. Their clothes are stunning. They want for nothing, I guess, in kind of material sense. They look amazing. They are living in the lap of luxury. Elizabeth Montagu is kind of fabulously wealthy for the period. So she's one of the lucky ones.
And the name blue stockings, there's all kinds of talk about where it came from, about whether or not it was from a man who they said, you know, don't bother getting dressed up, come in your blue stockings. So tell me about like the process of getting dressed as a woman. What do you, you know, when these women were writing, what are they wearing to write?
Montagu was famous for wearing diamonds. Actually, Frances Burney writes a really interesting thing about this. Her sort of mentor, a guy called Samuel Crisp, who she calls Daddy, he's...
Daddy Crisp. It's unfortunate.
It is. He's sort of chivying her about her second novel, Cecilia, and he's saying, come on, you know, it's just a novel. Just get on and write it. You know, why is it taking so long? I want to read it. And she's saying, well, I'm working on a cap. He says, well, you know, what a cap's in comparison. And she says, you know, a cap has to be made and a dinner has to be made unless I am to go capless and dinnerless. So, you know, there's this sense that she has to be mending her clothes and, you know, sort of doing the small minutiae of her everyday life, even as she's producing this eagerly anticipated novel. So for somebody like her, without that personal wealth, you know, you not only have to be thinking about what you're wearing, but you have to be constantly repairing and mending it.
That's right, because there's a book that came out last year by Catherine Marcel, which is called Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner? And it points out that, you know, Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations because, he lived with his mum, mm-hmm. who was widowed, and she put his dinner on the table every night. And, but for women writers, even those of them who were of relatively genteel birth, there were lots of competing, you know, Frances Burney being an obvious example, you know, your time was very, very often not your own. But I'm guessing, so you would have been wearing stockings... That you probably maybe woolen stockings at this point, like...
Probably, yes. Caps, hats, ribbons. I mean, it sort of depends when in the 18th century you're talking about, because fashion, as I understand it, changes enormously. But in the 1760s, 1770s, there's this rage for unbelievable hairstyles, you know, which could be up to a few feet high. So this is where you get these towers of grey hair coming from, and they're grey because of hair powder, which is very fashionable to wear. You're not supposed to let anyone see the true colour of your hair. And they're adorned with kind of, you know, fake flowers, fake butterflies, whatever it might be, these huge arrangements.
Boats.
And Liz, talking about, you know, living in a female body in this time, how many of the writers that we've been talking about had children?
That's a good question.
So Aphra Behn, we don't know of any. Eliza Haywood, they might be...
A couple.
Yeah, some, yeah. We don't know. People like the blue stockings, you know, did they...
Yeah, Burney has one child kind of late in life, aged mm-hmm. maybe 40 or so. Mm-hmm. Edgeworth never marries. She's another of these figures who's kind of an amanuensis to her dad her whole life. Hester Thrale, I guess, is an anomaly because she spends her married life with Henry Thrale kind of permanently pregnant. And she says, with my head in a basin 6 months of the year, because she's terribly, terribly sick. But her story is a very sad one because she has miscarriages. She has 12 live children, live births, and I think of which only four survived to adulthood.
Because that's, tell me if I'm wrong, I've got a horrible feeling that Samuel Richardson has about five children, or his wife has about five children, and they're all called Samuel because none of them survive. And he just sort of like, and which I just think by the time you're on Samuel 4, you sort of think, God, you know, maybe the name is cursed. This is what I should stop with. But I think that's something that I find it really interesting to try and reconnect with these women's lives. Mm. You know, this was a time when, you know, there was no birth control. Well, for some people, there was some, but you know, you had sheep gut condoms and things like that, but that was more kind of a brothel-y thing, maybe for venereal disease. But a lot of these women writers, their lives would have been dictated by motherhood and by caring responsibilities.
I think it would actually be fair to say, looking at the majority of successful 18th century female writers, that they don't have children, or that they do a lot of their writing before they have a child later in life. There are exceptions. Hester Thrale Piozzi is one of them. Charlotte Smith is another one who we haven't spoken about yet. She's a novelist and poet from the 1780s through till the early 19th century. And she has, I think, 13 births, 9 of whom grow up to adulthood. And she has to make it part of her authorial identity that she is a dutiful mother, and she writes in the service of providing for her children. But now you mention it, there's really not that many.
When you think about women in the period, you know, how tough did you have to be even to survive multiple pregnancies and multiple births? You know, if you made it at all, that was probably something of an achievement.
Yeah, I just, when I was writing my piece last year's New Statesman about politics, and you actually say, well, there's not necessarily a problem with being a woman in politics, there's a problem with being a primary parent, which often means a mother in politics, you know, that, and the difference of number of children between the shadow cabinet, between the average number the men had and the women had, is really astonishing. The number of, you know, Scotland, you know, has got 3 female leaders, none of whom have children. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what, you know, Theresa May, the highest woman in the government, doesn't have children. What becomes very obvious is that actually, for aspirations, being a caregiver is really tough, because it's like socialism, it takes up too many evenings. And then you look at the medieval period, and the women writers that have often survived from then, you know, Julian of Norwich, people like that, were religious women. They were, you know, they were perpetual virgins. They just didn't, they found a space to write by opting out of a family life.
Mm-hmm. And yet for Hester Piozzi, Hester Thrale as she was, I guess writing, having children is one of the things that starts to create her as a writer, because she keeps manuscripts called things like the children's book, where she records all their ailments. She's terrified, after she's lost so many, she's terrified any ailment they have. She's terrified this is a sign that she's going to lose yet another child. So it's one of the things, for her at least, that begins her writing life, is writing about her children, although it's only when they're a little bit older and when she's married for a second time that she actually becomes a published writer.
And in the literary kind of discourse around the time about the education of women, is there some emphasis on we must educate the mothers because then they'll bring up important people, i.e. boys?
It's really important to Hester Thrale, because she's one of the lucky ones. She's unusual in that she does receive a sort of classical education. She learns French. I think she knows 4 languages by the time she's a teenager. And then she pours everything, so she tells us, into educating her children in turn. It's a real mission for her.
And this, Sophie, oh, sorry.
Sorry. I was just going to say, the conduct literature that you mentioned, really, really important here. You know, these books, which do essentially what they say on the can, they're like sort of a cross between etiquette manual and a magazine advice column and a didactic kind of religious treatise, usually written by older men for younger women and advising them on how to behave and how to conduct themselves. And there's this real culture of reflecting on what are women for. And I think you've hit the nail on the head in that where writers are able to justify and to celebrate female education, female learning, it's often in the sense that they are going to be the mothers of the great men of the future. So we need to sort of invest in them for that reason.
And I wanted to know, talking about material conditions, was there any kind of equivalent of blue stocking culture of these female literary, you know, clubs for working class or even lower middle class women?
I would be inclined to say, well, I would say I haven't heard of any sort of labouring class blue stocking club. But it does put me in mind of the story of Anne Yearsley, which might be briefly illustrative here. Anne Yearsley is this labouring class poet. She's a milkwoman from Clifton near Bristol. And Hannah Moore, who is a sort of middle class genteel writer affiliated with Elizabeth Montagu's Blue Stocking Circle, discovers that Yearsley writes these unbelievable poems. And she sort of is amazed at this, and she takes Yearsley up and starts to patronise her. She introduces her privately to Elizabeth Montagu, and she and Montagu start to raise subscriptions, which is a kind of 18th century crowdfunding for Yearsley's first book of poetry. You might say, kind of, isn't that lovely and what a heartwarming story, but unfortunately it goes rather sour, because once this book of poems has been published and it's immensely successful, Moore and Montagu, the patrons, decide that they should have control of Yearsley's earnings rather than her, because she's a labouring class woman who isn't going to be trusted to spend them properly. There's a rift. Eventually Yearsley gets her earnings, but she's totally cut off from the blue stockings. But even at the height of the friendship and the patronage, Yearsley is not invited to blue stocking gatherings. She's not seen as an appropriate person to be there, despite her talent. She actually writes the most wonderful passive-aggressive poetry about it, addressed to Moore, to Stella on a visit to Mrs. Montagu, which talks about how unworthy she and Yearsley is to attend these gatherings. I think that story can tell us something about how the blue stocking circle, despite such a commendable aim of nurturing talent and women of all stations, fell rather short in that respect.
And is that a part of a wider story of middle class and upper class women trying to gain respectability for their own literary pursuits by emphasising quite how rarefied, how restrained, how ladylike they were?
Mm.
The blue stocking circle is a moment in which, it's an amazing moment really for women's history, because it's a point when women's cultural achievement is celebrated almost perhaps as never before or since. It's a period in which women come to be a kind of index of the nation's civility.
And what do you mean by that? I mean, in the sense that who praises the blue stockings then? Are there male writers sort of holding them, them up?
Round about the mid-century, there's this real move to kind of commemorate them, to list them, to write praise poetry to them, and kind of compile these lists of eminent women who kind of glorify the nation in some way, kind of much as Montagu has done with Shakespeare and said, okay, here's our national bard. They kind of reflect a little bit in that light as well, and they become national treasures.
But it's quite problematic, isn't it? Because underlying this celebration, this kind of boasting, oh, France, our women are more intelligent than yours, which is the shape it often takes, there's also a sense of anxiety about what this learning might do to masculinity, to intellectual culture. And, you know, people like women like Montagu, who have a very real social power, often have kind of images of transvestism associated with them. You know, she talks in a masculine way, people often say. So there's this notion that, you know, she is celebrated on the one hand, but on the other hand, there's something that, you know, these male commentators don't quite like
it. It's
about
so
it.
Fragile.
Yeah.
And so hard won. And it doesn't last, I guess.
Well, that's the final question, really, which is, when blue stocking culture dies out, is it because the founders die out, or is there a cultural shift behind it?
Really good question. There's, you know, there are certain circles made up of particular people, some of whom we've touched on in this episode, who drift apart, who die, who go their separate ways, who have rifts. And by 1825, Thomas Rowlandson is able to publish this magnificent, horrible cartoon called The Breakup of the Blue Stocking Club, which is just a kind of scram of women pulling each other's hair and burning each other with candles and cats flying everywhere. You know, so it's partly due to individual personalities and some well-publicised rifts. But I don't know, I suppose there's something around the turn of the 19th century.
I think it's, I mean, we'll get to the 1790s in another episode, but I think the 1790s changes everything. The political agenda is so different, and the level of public debate, again, is so much changed from then, from compared with the mid-century, that I guess that the luxury, in a sense, of being able to have these debates about what do women mean and how should we value them or not, has they threatened us? That's not the debate to have in after the French Revolution.
I was going to say, is it a symptom of the general anxiety that you see in the kind of work of Sir Edmund Burke and people like that, about the feeling that, you know, France has overturned everything? You know, France has had this chopping off people's heads left, right, and centre. You know, where is the enemy that is going to overturn our society, everything that we've hard fought for? Oh my God, is it women? Oh my God, they're right here. It's coming from inside the house.
I think that might be spot on, actually. What you see in the 1790s, which is as Liz said, is, you know, a whole other episode, is this unsettling of distinctions. And it's partly a result of what happens in France, but just everything starts to become unsettled. And that's productive of a huge amount of anxiety and backlash. And gender, I think, becomes subjected to that. And suddenly where it was, you know, where one could transgress, one could slip through the cracks earlier in the century, somehow it becomes a lot more shocking to do so in that climate.
Well, we'll come back in a next episode to some of the attacks on women writers, but just before you leave us, I'm quite into the idea of you setting us homework every week. Is there something that you'd recommend reading from that comes out of that period?
If you're interested in finding out about the Blue Stockings, anything by Elizabeth Ager, who's at King's College London. There's also a book called Small Change by Harriet Guest, which is about, which has this wonderful section on women as a national treasure with that kind of anxiety creating underbelly also. In terms of primary sources, what do you think?
It's really difficult because these are not necessarily women known for novels or poetry.
Go away and read Epictetus in Elizabeth Carter's translation.
I'm going to say probably not.
But it's their lives. It's the way we could read them now is in some ways parallel to how they might have been read at the time, which is it's them, it's their lives and their conversation, these women as figures. That's the interesting thing. You don't have any direct access to them, but you can read of them and you can get this kind of partial glimpse of them, which maintains their kind of propriety, but you still get to know the gossip.
But is there even a scholarly biography of Elizabeth Montagu, let alone a kind of popular one?
That's an excellent question. I don't, not for a long time.
Just going to say gap in the market, guys.
Yeah. there's a few of Hester Thrale Piozzi out there.
Every copy which has been like signed by you two. Love her. Well, we'll come back to that. But yeah, for the moment, if you say there's more Blue Stocking reading out there. But for the moment, thank you very much to Liz and Sophie.
Thanks.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You've been listening to the New Statesman's History Podcast, Hidden Histories, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by India Burke. Our music is Jean-Baptiste Lully's Gavotte, performed by Thrax, and is licensed under Creative Commons. For more information about the writers and works discussed in this programme, visit newstatesman.com/podcast.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.